I actually don't need the podium, I suppose, but I'll use it. More official that way. My name is Mary Black Junton, and I'm the music librarian here at Michigan State University, where I have been since I was just a toddler. I'm in my 51st year working for the MSU Libraries. And it is my pleasure tonight to introduce to you our speaker. Baritone Harlan Jennings is an associate professor of voice at Michigan State University College of Music. He holds the Doctor of Musical Arts degree from the University of Cincinnati. He's the author of over a dozen articles dealing with the history of opera in the American West. He has sung with a number of regional opera companies, including Michigan Opera Theater, Opera Grand Rapids, the Toledo Opera, and the St. Louis Municipal Opera. In addition, he has appeared frequently on public television in the Artistry of series piloted by WKAR-TV. And recently, Dr. Jennings and Dr. Ann Nispel released the second CD in their Crosslight series, Crosslights of British and French Song. And you can check that out from the Fine Arts Library. So enjoy the speech. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary. Before we get started, I would like to thank a number of people who've worked behind the scenes here at the MSU Library. This is our fifth year of the Music in American Life series, and these people make this thing possible. Cliff Hocke, of course, director of the library, Mary Black, Teresa Moore, who's in graphics, John Shaw, Rick Pfeiffer, Paul Cooper, and Michael Laney, who is our stage manager and troubleshooter, tech director, general factotum tonight. Horace Tabor, Baby Doe, and Denver's Grand Opera House. Preamble. Colorado men are we, from the peaks gigantic, from the great Sierras and the high plateaus, from the mine and from the gully, from the hunting trail we come. Pioneers, oh pioneers, minstrels latent on the prairies, shrouded bards of other lands, you may rest, you have done your work. Soon I hear you coming, warbling. Soon you rise and tramp amid us. Pioneers, oh pioneers. Walt Whitman. The meaning of Colorado. Colorado, what does it mean? Whence the word that was used to name this part of the Great West? Well, it seems its origin is Spanish, and historians have traced the name back to the 15th century Spanish explorers, who referred to the region as Colorado because of its red-colored earth. Denver's inaccessibility. No major river, no major trails. When gold was discovered in 1858, the Denver area was fairly isolated. At its back, it was hemmed in by the Rocky Mountains, just to the west. When it looked to the east, Denver saw nothing but a vast open plain stretching into limitless space. Omaha and Kansas City, the two nearest towns of any consequence, lay 500 to 600 miles to the east, while St. Louis, a major outfitting center for the gold rush and the gold fields around Denver, was nearly 1,000 miles away. Denver was situated on no major river, nor any major trail. So let's look at the Oregon Trail. This famous trail did not come within 200 miles of the Denver area. And people were using this in the 1840s. So here it is, and it's up here going into central Wyoming. Denver's way down there. Not going to do Denver very much good. Next, we'll look at the Santa Fe. Whoops, we skipped a slide. I don't see Denver. We're going to have to downsize this just a bit. There's Denver. Okay, so Santa Fe Trail starts in Independence at the time this map was made. There are two ways you could go. Here's the Cimarron cutoff. That would save you 300 miles. The problem was that there was no water. So very risky. I've been out here at Point of Rocks in the extreme southwest part of the state in the summer, and you can still see the wagon tracks there. But there's no water in the Cimarron River in the summer. So most people went the other way, and here's Bent's Fort on the Arkansas River. That's as close as you get to Denver. Denver's clear up here, at least 150 miles away, maybe 200. So that's not much help either, especially if you're a theatrical manager. The location of Denver meant that the city was bypassed by many of the early entertainment troops. Then the railroads came. The signal achievement was the completion of the first transcontinental rail line, which, you guessed it, ran well north of Denver across southern Wyoming. So let's get back here to the big picture. So there it is. And as you can see, it's here's Cheyenne, goes through Cheyenne, but Denver's clear down here. Again, I'd guess that's 100 miles. But never fear, help was on the way. A year later, there was a completion in 1870 into Denver of two rail lines, the Kansas Pacific running westward from Kansas City, and the other a spur from the Transcontinental Union Pacific Main Line in Cheyenne. And these, of course, facilitated access to Colorado's major city. So here's a map of the Kansas Pacific. Green shaded area was completed in 1869, and the red shaded area the rest of the way to Denver in 1870. Both shaded areas indicate areas of land, land grants that are available to settlers. And this, here's Cheyenne, and the spur is coming right down there. So both of those, now Denver is hooked up. And here is a roundhouse from the Kansas Pacific Railway, Armstrong, Kansas, 1873. Here are a bunch of these engines from the period. They're all lined up like racehorses at the Kentucky Derby, and I assume they're ready to surge forward in search of opera. Despite the advent of the railroads, major opera companies still avoided Denver. Too many playing dates could be lost reaching the city and leaving it. And the town lacked a properly equipped theater with enough seating to make opera financially attractive. Thus, Denver's early exposure to grand opera was piecemeal and of uneven quality. And now we get to Denver's first opera company, which arrived in the summer of 1877. This was the Richings Bernard Grand English Opera Company, consisting of 30 artists and headed by soprano Caroline Richings, who was the earliest American, we think of her as American. She was born in Britain, but she spent most of her life here. The first of a long series of American prima donnas who championed opera in English in the United States. Anyway, she opened July 16th at the Forrester Opera House with William Vincent Wallace's Mauritania, opera by a British composer. On the following three evenings, the troupe gave in English The Bohemian Girl, Martha, and Il Trovatore to full houses and enthusiastic reviews. Needless to say, all were Denver premieres. Culture-starved Denverites could not seem to get enough opera. Noted the Denver Times, quote, Tonight, Martha will be rendered, and many Denver people are spending the day in reading it up. In fact, the musical and literary part of the population are giving the week, night and day, to opera, and follow the entertainment with sharp criticisms. In a scene reminiscent of Jenny Lind's concerts in St. Louis almost 20 years earlier, the Forrester Opera House could not hold all who wished to attend the Trovatore performance of July 19th. And here's a quote from the Times. Last night, Curtis Street, opposite the Opera House, was filled with the crowd who, being unable to gain access to the hall, adopted that mode of enjoying the music. The Curtis Street audience were on foot, on horseback, in carriages, and on the pickets of Mr. Charles' fence. They were well-dressed, orderly, and between the acts did not go out to see a man. Now, to see a man is a phrase that refers to ducking into a nearby saloon to have a drink. The opera season was judged a great success. A grateful Denver Tribune stated, "We extend the thanks of our whole people to Mrs. Bernard. She was the first to bring a legitimate opera troupe to our city, and in so doing, took quite a risk upon herself. She has set an example that we hope to see followed by other companies. If Mrs. Bernard should decide at any time in the future to return to Denver, she may rest assured that she will be cordially invited." The silver boom. By the end of the 1870s, Denver was riding the crest of another boom, this one brought about by the discovery of silver in the mountains west of Denver near Leadville. During this decade, the 1870s, Denver had experienced an eightfold increase in population from over 4,700 to over 35,000. The city's wealth and population having reached a kind of critical mass, the construction of a modern opera house seemed inevitable. To help push things along, the Rocky Mountain News had been attacking Nate Forrester and his opera house. And here's Nate. He came to Denver as an actor and later acquired the largest theater in town and became a manager as well. Anyway, he and the Rocky Mountain News were having a running feud by this time. The news declared that Forrester's facility had declined to a second-class place of resort, and that a new opera house under a new manager would be the only way to obtain first-class attractions in Denver. At the end of 1879, the newspaper ratcheted up the pressure for a new theater. "There is no possibility that the discussion of the proposed new opera house will die out until we get one that will answer our wants for a generation to come. The numerous cattlemen and mine owners who are making our city their winter headquarters are complaining loudly on the subject. To enjoy a gay and comfortable winter is their chief object in coming here, as they do with plenty of money to spend. The chief hope of our people is centered upon the known wealth and admitted liberality and enterprise of Lieutenant Governor Tabor." This was one of several times when he just happened to be serving as acting governor. He served in this capacity for almost the whole month of September. That was 2 years later when the Opera House was going up. I correct myself. He was acting governor then, but he was had been elected lieutenant governor in 1878. So here's a slide of the man himself. Silver magnate Horace Tabor had already built a modest opera house in Leadville. Now, motivated by a characteristic blend of self-promotion and philanthropy, Tabor announced that he would build Denver the opera house it deserved. At the same time, Nate Forrester relinquished the management of his theater, which soon closed, leaving Tabor with a clear field. Tabor and his architect, W.J. Edbrook, went east to inspect other opera facilities and to gather ideas. Construction began in the summer of 1880. Tabor proclaimed that no expense would be spared in bringing to Denver the finest opera house in the West. Accordingly, Edbrook imported cherry wood from Japan, mahogany from Honduras, and paintings from Europe to adorn the interior. There was also carpeting from Brussels, tapestry from Belgium and Paris, lots of good stuff. He spent a small fortune on this. A single order from Marshall Field in Chicago, consisting of silk plush chairs, tapestry, and carpeting, amounted to $15,714, which doesn't sound like a lot, but to get it in today's money, you need to multiply everything by 20. So now we're over 300,000. Estimates of the total cost of the multi-story opera house block range from $750,000 to $850,000. Well, that's 15 to 17 million, isn't it? An extravagant sum. So here's the exterior of the opera house. This is a photograph courtesy of the Colorado Hysterical Society, taken a couple of years after the opera house opened. And now we'll get a slide of the lavish interior on which Tabor spent the modern equivalent of 2 million smackers. So there we are. Look at the boxes in that turret. Pretty fancy, huh? Tabor was determined to make the opening of his opera house the grandest cultural and social event in the history of Colorado, and he decided that his theater should be dedicated with a two-week opera season beginning September 5th, 1881. Tabor selected America's most popular prima donna, Illinois native Emma Abbott, and her grand English opera company to do the honors, offering her a lavish guarantee of $20,000, that's $400,000, plus over $3,000 for rail fare, over $60,000 for rail fare. That's not too shabby. So here's Emma Abbott. This is a slide from the Harvard Theatrical Collection. There she is in her Lucia costume. And here she is next with her favorite tenor, her favorite leading man, William Castle, and there they are in the balcony scene of Gounod's Romeo and Juliet. Horace Tabor had much in common with Emma Abbott. Both were native born, both were very ambitious, both had risen to prominence from modest beginnings, and both had built their reputations far from the eastern centers of culture and commerce. Tabor's decision to have an opera season in English may have stemmed from his deeply held beliefs about egalitarianism and accessibility, notions that enjoyed wide acceptance throughout the American West, and still do today, for that matter, out there. As the inaugural engagement drew near, the Denver Press published a barrage of articles concerning all aspects of the grand opening, including the appropriate attire. In response to a reader's letter of inquiry, the Rocky Mountain News expressed the following opinion. Everyone who goes to the Tabor Opera House will think with pleasure that this place, grand as it is equally open to the millionaire and the mechanic. America is a republic, not a monarchy, And there is no monarch here to dictate in what style of apparel his subjects shall appear. Let no one who desires to attend the opera be kept away on account of the lack of elegant and expensive clothes. The opera house was not built for the select few, but for the people. Recall the Gettysburg Address. Let Denver's young men who are desirous of doing the correct thing look at the man who owns the magnificent structure and let them copy, in this respect, Colorado's plain and unassuming son. Much of the hubbub around town focused on Emma Abbott, whose greatest talent perhaps lay in her uncanny ability to stay in the spotlight, all the while charming press and public. Abbott had announced that she would offer the premiere of her newly devised, cleaned-up version of La Traviata. This revelation surprised many of her followers, for several years earlier, Miss Abbott had declared that she would never sing Traviata because of its immoral libretto. In fact, while under contract with James Henry Mapleson's London troupe, she had refused to sing Violetta, causing the impresario to bring suit against her. Now, however, she had reconsidered, and the work was in rehearsal. Abbott assured reporters that the libretto, rewritten by wordsmiths of her own choosing, had been purged of all objectionable elements, while the original music had been retained. Abbott had renamed the opera Cecilia's Love. A week before opening night, Abbott's advance man, Charles Pratt, gave an interview to the Denver Tribune. Speaking of Abbott's interpretation of Lucia, Pratt boasted, "In the third scene where the heroine becomes insane, the effect upon the audience is magical. And there are many who have declined to believe that the heroine, for the time being, was not actually insane. So realistic was the part." Well, I'm sure many of us who go to opera performances have found ourselves thinking that about the soprano on the stage at the time, haven't we? Certainly. So this isn't much of a stretch. When the reporter asked how Miss Abbott had acquired such an intimate knowledge of the phases of insanity, Pratt replied, "Through visiting the asylums for the insane all through the states and studying for hours the faces and actions of those affected with the mania." Keep your boots on, there's more stuff flowing in your direction. Arriving in Denver, September 3rd, Abbott granted an interview with the Tribune in which she defended her moral position regarding La Traviata. The article bore the unmistakable hand of the mischievous Eugene Field, St. Louis-born, famous humorist, writer of children's books, and the Tribune's new managing editor. He looks ornery, doesn't he? And he was. "Oh, that was horrid, what you said about my Traviata in the Tribune the other day," exclaimed Miss Abbott petulantly. "Did you not register a solemn vow in high heaven never to sing Traviata?" asked the reporter. "Very true, I did," said the little singer, adding, "and don't fancy for one moment that the principles that guided me through a rough and stormy girlhood have been abandoned on reaching womanhood. I could not, as a true woman, undertake to personify and make attractive the character of one whose occupation in life has been the ruin of men and the making of untold misery for her own sex. No, I could never enact the role of Violetta." In the same issue of the Tribune, Eugene Field, ever quick to to deflate self-righteous personages, targeted Abbott's decision to hold a Sunday morning rehearsal prior to the Monday night opening. "We are grieved," this was printed in his paper, the Tribune, "we are grieved to learn that Miss Abbott has ordered a rehearsal of her Traviata in the Opera House this morning. Our confidence in the lady's piety was such that we sent her a perfume note last evening inviting her to occupy our pew in church today." Abbott, keenly aware of the public's attitude regarding the morals of actresses, had worked vigorously throughout her career to maintain an image of the utmost integrity. However, she wisely chose not to reply to Field's teasing remarks, and thereafter they became friends. As it happened, the Sunday morning rehearsal did not take place because the Carpenters, who were behind schedule, as they usually are, needed to work on the stage. Sunday afternoon with Miss Emma. On Sunday afternoon, September 4th, Miss Abbott, who knew a thing or two about public relations, managed to have a reporter at her side when she visited the new opera house for the first time. Horace Tabor was waiting to greet her and gave her a guided tour of the facility. As she strolled through the interior, Abbott gushed, "It is the grandest opera house in the world, with the exception of the Grand Opera House in Paris, and in some respects, this is ahead. The boxes are finer." Later, as she took a carriage ride, Abbott confessed to an eager reporter that she had been smitten with the city. "How many pretty homes there are here. Do you know Jean," her husband Eugene Wetherell, "Jean says he thinks we'd better come here to live. He is so pleased with the place." Opening night. The next evening, September 5th, 1881, Denver inaugurated one of the most magnificent opera houses in North America. The opening night opera was William Vincent Wallace's Maritana. Despite a chilly drizzle, a capacity crowd of 1,500 filled the Tabor Grand, and that was the capacity of the house. This, courtesy of the Colorado Historical Society, is an opening night silk and satin souvenir program. And next to it is, there's a cast list from one of the interior pages. Though Abbott had chosen Mauritania as the inaugural entertainment, she could not resist beginning the evening by singing the Mad Scene. So the Mad Scene with her alone on stage was the first thing that happened that night. Immediately following the Mad Scene, Horace Tabor was called to the stage as thunderous applause rocked the auditorium. And this is an account from the Rocky Mountain News. "Looking uncomfortable in his formal attire, Horace stood while his career was briefly reviewed, gracious tributes paid him, and a special poem read to honor the occasion. On this, his special evening, he was presented with an autograph album and a golden watch fob symbolizing his rise from minor to owner of the Tabor Grand." Here's a photograph courtesy of the Colorado Historical Society. This is the front, which depicts, it's probably difficult for you to see, but from top to bottom, first is the Tabor Opera House block, then right below that, the exterior of the Tabor Opera House, and then the third panel there is the Leadville Mine, where he made his fortune, perhaps the little Pittsburgh Mine, and then at the very bottom is a bucket of silver ore. Now this is the back, and this I had trouble making out. The top panel is an illegible inscription. The second panel appears to be an intertwining of his initials, H.A.W. Tabor, H-A-W-T. I don't know what the third panel is, and the bucket of silver ore, of course, is at the bottom. And here he is again. And at this point, after the presentation, Tabor, of course, made a response. And here it is, according to the Rocky Mountain News of the next day. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, it is 16 months since I commenced the building of this opera house. At that time, I looked Denver carefully over, and here I found the finest city, I think, of its population on the American continent. I said if Denver is to have an opera house, it should have one worthy of the city. Here is the opera house. I shall leave it to your judgment if I have done my duty in this respect." There was applause, probably lots of it. "Here is this beautiful album and fob chain, as beautiful as can be. I shall prize them every hour I live. I shall prize them not for their price value, but for the spirit in which they are given." With applause ringing in his ears, Tabor left the stage, and the performance of Maritana began. His triumph, however, harbored a hollow center. Separated from his long dedicated wife, Augusta, Tabor had decided not to sit in his private box, which was festooned with his name in floral letters. It remained empty throughout the performance. There was no sign of Augusta, even though she had written 2 days earlier begging to accompany him to the opening. And this letter is at the Colorado Historical Society. And here it is. "Believe me that none will be more proud than your broken-hearted wife. Will you not take me there? And by so doing, stop the gossip that is busy with our affairs. God knows that I am truly sorry for our estrangement, and I will humble myself in the dust at your feet if you will only return. Whatever I said to you was done in the heat of passion, and you know the awful condition I was in when it was said. Pity, I beseech you, and forgive me, and let us bury the past and commence anew, and my life shall be devoted to you forever. Your loving wife, Augusta." Tabor, unbending, attended the opera without her. His romantic interest lay elsewhere, with the lovely Elizabeth McCourt, nicknamed Baby Doe. Here are a couple of photographs of Augusta. There she is as a young girl on the left. In the center, that's the house where she and Horace Tabor lived in Leadville. And on the right, there she is in the 1880s. And here's Elizabeth McCourt, Baby Doe. She was known as Baby because of her youthful, winsome appearance, and possibly because of her relatively diminutive stature. Newspaper accounts of the grand opening were ecstatic. Headlines from the Rocky Mountain News blared, "Perfection! Tabor's great triumph opened last night. The grandest milestone in Denver's career, fitly dedicated by America's favorite." Denver's pride knew no bounds, as the news exclaimed. "The Tabor Opera House is completed, and Denver may justly boast of this last gift from her generous son. Wealth and taste, art and science, have all combined to give to this Western world a temple fit to be the amusement hall for the kings of earth. Let no one call Colorado a barren waste, or speak of it as a wild, rocky place. Talk not of the generous-hearted Westerner as rough and uncultured, for here stands a monument to the culture, good taste, and refinement of the state that 10 years ago was not. Abbott's repertoire of blitz. The remainder of the inaugural season proved a huge success. Over the next 2 weeks, the Abbott organization mounted 9 additional full-length productions, a remarkable achievement for any touring company, and especially so early in the touring season. They had just started out. They had dedicated a brand new opera house in Springfield, Ohio on August 27th that was owned by the Lieutenant Governor of Ohio, and they had come directly by train out to Denver. And here's what they did in Denver. Lucia, Fra Diavolo, 2 performances. Trovatore, Martha, 2 performances of that. Olivet, Bohemian Girl, 2 performances. Faust, that's Gounod's Faust, Cecilia's Love. And the Chimes of Normandy. Abbott sang every night with the exception of 2. September 8th and 14th. That's a lot of singing. Eugene Field responded to the opera season with several poems, as well as a good deal of rhetorical mischief. Field and the Tribune playfully poked fun at the owner and editor of the Rocky Mountain News, John Arkins, assigning him the rank of colonel. Eugene Field's Merry Pranks. In its illustration of the interior of the Rocky Mountain News, Field wrote in the Tribune, the news of yesterday morning represented the Tribune box as being full of ladies. This was due, we suppose, to the excessive gallantry of Colonel John Arkins, who, by the way, has been trying to palm himself off as a bachelor among the chorus singers of the Abbott troupe. In a poem entitled Tabor and Abbott, Field indulged in one of his favorite pranks, signing someone else's name to one of his literary efforts. These verses he attributed to R.W. Woodbury, editor of the Denver Times. The first stanza was later used by Douglas Moore in the Ballad of Baby Doe, but neither Moore nor his librettist may have known the true authorship of the poem. So the first poem, the first stanza, the lines that were used in the opera are, the opera house, a union grand of capital and labor, long will the stately structure stand, a monument to Tabor. I believe that's sung by the chorus. Then there are a couple of stanzas that I have omitted, and then it ends. For many a year and many a year, our folks will have the habit of lauding that illustrious pair, Tabor and Emma Abbott. Signed, Colonel R.W. Woodbury. Deacon Evans. More mischief. The billiard ball. In the same issue of the Tribune, Field took aim at another of Denver's prominent citizens, John Evans, second governor of Colorado Territory and a prominent Methodist. Field always referred to Evans as the deacon. Field spotted Evans at the first performance of the Bohemian Girl and filed this report. Deacon John Evans was at the opera last night, sitting, as we expected he would be, in the front row of the parquet. His bald, venerable head glistened like a billiard ball under the glare of the gas jets, and his little round eyes sparkled like diamonds all through the bedchamber scene. When Miss Abbott began to disrobe, the good deacon's face fairly glowed with expectation, and he licked his chops with all the delirious fervency of a small boy about to tackle a plum pudding. Learning 3 weeks later that Evans had slapped the Tribune with three libel suits of $100,000 each, Field had the last word in print, as you would expect. Whom the deacon loveth, he chasteneth. Abbott's visit proved one of those unusual engagements that generated good feelings all around. Even the Baptists came out in favor of opera. In a September 4th sermon, the Reverend Reuben Jeffrey of the First Baptist Church, speaking on the topic of worldliness, stated that, quote, true religion had no war to make against art. He believed that such grand edifices as the Opera House, dedicated to the highest forms of art, were a benefit to all classes of people. Jeffrey hoped the time would soon come when he himself might attend such performances as were to be given at the Opera House. One reason for the good humor on all sides was that everyone had made money. After the first week, the total receipts stood at over $14,000. Well, that's more like $290,000 in today's currency. The two-week total of $27,600, in other words, over $500,000, an average of nearly $40,000 per performance also set a record. It was not until the Metropolitan Opera's engagement of 1900 at the Broadway Theater that Abbott's single-week box office record was broken, so it held for 19 years. Thanks in part to the Abbott engagement, during the first year of operation, the Tabor Grand showed receipts slightly in excess of $200,000, so that's $4 million, and a net profit of $31,000, that's over $600,000, respectively, in today's dollars. The heyday of the Tabor Grand, it didn't last very long. It lasted only 9 years. In August of 1890, the Broadway Theater opened. And thereafter, most of the leading attractions came to the Broadway rather than to the Tabor. Between 1881 and 1890, however, the Tabor Grand hosted a number of operatic luminaries. Emma Abbott, who returned to Denver no fewer than 6 times, remained Denver's most popular prima donna until her death in 1891 in Salt Lake City, just before her company was scheduled to give yet another Denver season of opera. Under the title of The Elite, George D. Betts published programs for theaters in St. Louis and Denver from the late 1870s into the 1880s. The cover illustration often featured a view of the current production or a likeness of the star or entrepreneur. That's Emma Abbott, of course, and this is for one of the engagements in the 1880s, I'm not sure which. We can narrow this next one down. It's probably September 23rd. It's certainly September 1882, Abbott's second season at the Tabor Grand. And of course, that's Horace Tabor on the cover. And here's an interior page from September 23rd, 1882, showing the casts for matinee and evening performances of King for a Day and Chimes of Normandy, both light operas. Adam is the, I believe, Adolphe Adam is the composer. King for a Day, Chimes of Normandy is another French composer, Planquette. Abbott did a lot of light or comic operas as well as more serious operas like Romeo and Juliet, Faust, and Cecilia's Love. Horace Tabor's fortunes approximated those of his opera house. Financial reverses in the early and mid-1890s left him bankrupt, and he was forced to sell his opera house in 1896. Eventually, it became a decrepit third-run movie house and was torn down in 1964. Tabor went back to work. Here he is as working as a day laborer. The slide says working as a slag man at the smelter in Leadville. $3 a day is what he was being paid. And he was already in his early 60s. But there he is, back doing fairly hard physical labor. He didn't quit. Charitably appointed postmaster of Denver in 1898, when he would have been between 65 and 70, 68, I think. I think he was born in 1830. After being virtually destitute, Tabor died the following year, appendicitis. The verse that Tabor had chosen to adorn the opera house drop curtain, words later used by Douglas Moore in the Ballad of Baby Doe, had proved prophetic. So fleet the works of men back to earth again, ancient and holy things fade like a dream. Here's a photograph of the house curtain, courtesy of the Colorado Historical Society. Robert Hopkins was the artist. He was a Detroit native. And now, a sad tale about the opera house curtain's demise. The house curtain suffered an ignoble demise. It remained in the Tabor Grand until the building was torn down in 1964. At that time, according to the account in the Rocky Mountain News, the curtain was donated to the Central City Opera House Association. But the curtain was too large for the stage in Central City, and cutting it down would have ruined the design. So it was stored locally and left undisturbed for 18 years. The building had a leaky roof. But Central City had no funds for maintenance and no other place to store the curtain. According to Frank Gates, a former scenic designer at the Central City Opera, the remains of the famous Tabor Opera House curtain were hauled to the Central City dump and burned in 1982. If you haven't had enough, there are a couple of places where you can find more about tonight's topic. And now, if there are any questions, I will try to dodge them as best I can while trying to appear knowledgeable. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you. Thank you. There are microphones here at your service. Dr. Herr Professor Donald Hall, sir.
I was here to harass you with a question. This was a marvelous, exposition of grand opera, the Great Plains, in the last few decades of the 1800s. Why do I get the feeling that following that period, grand opera in the Great Plains went into decline, and only recently is shown in more local opera theaters an attempt at resurrection? Is it because the robber barons, the ultra-rich, have sort of left the scene, or the culture has changed. I'm wondering what your interpretation of the following period of this glorious golden year of operas was not followed by a continuation.
Well, it was for opera remained popular for quite a while, at least through the end of World War II, World War I, to about 1920. The decline started near the end of the First World War. There were things now like the Nickelodeon, the forerunner of movies. Radio came in later, of course, and of course now there are all kinds of demands, entertainment demands on everyone's time. Lots and lots of distractions. There was also the Spanish flu in 1918, which made it unsafe to go to theaters for a while. In fact, many theaters closed down for months. But there were still touring companies that kept it up for a long time, and especially the Metropolitan Opera. But finally, of course, the Met gave up touring. When was that? Sometime in the 1980s? Is that when the tours finally stopped? Because they just couldn't make a go of it, right? Touring became more and more expensive. I think the modern equivalent of the old robber barons are still around, but people's cultural entertainment priorities, I think, have shifted just a bit. In the late 19th century, opera was pretty much the only game in town, aside from musical theater, and there was lots of Shakespeare, and traveling lecturers would come and give a lecture on the liver or whatever it was. And there were magic lantern shows. All kinds of things went on at the so-called opera house. That was just a euphemism for theater because of the unfortunate association of theaters, especially in the minds of the religious people, with prostitution, the ladies of the night. In fact, the Rocky Mountain News, during one time when they were warring with Nate Forrester, accused him of his theater being a resort for ladies of the pavement, and claiming that he always reserved the top tier for those folks and encouraged them. Of course, that wasn't true. But it shows you the mindset. Does that answer your question? I tried to dodge it as best I could, but.
So you think it's both a cultural interest shift as well as the lack of
I think so.
Huge support, which even today for opera is very difficult to achieve.
There was a bit of a revival in the 1970s with the Bicentennial, and there was this burgeoning of regional opera companies, and everybody, or nearly everybody, was doing operas in English, which I thought was a very good idea. But now you see the pendulum going back, and even many universities now don't do their productions in the vernacular. They're doing them in the original language, which, of course, you can make a very strong case for that, but it probably, in the long run, does not help opera's appeal with the general public, and it gives the general public an idea that opera is something for those other rich people and a place to show off your clothes, and it's sung in some bizarre language, and you have to study and really prepare for it, because it's not done in English, so you're not going to know what's going on otherwise. I think it's a big deterrent. And Besides, you can just stay at home and watch TV or get on your computer and see things. Why bestir yourself and go to the trouble of coming down to the MSU campus, trying to find a place to park, all the while watching out for bicyclists and skateboarders who will come out of the gloom without warning at top speed. It's hazardous. Yes, Callie.
What would you do with your wealth if you struck silver?
Well, of course, all of us on the music faculty don't need to concern ourselves with having that kind of ship dock at our particular port of call, because as music professors, as you know, we are among the highest salaried professors on the campus. But if we won the lotto, like that nice lady did down in Three Rivers, I don't know. Not sure what I would do. I would keep teaching. I wouldn't quit my job, like she did. Well, I don't blame her. I mean, she didn't have a nice, cushy job like we voice teachers have here at MSU. She probably really had to work for her money. And it was probably full of a lot of drudgery, whereas we have the privilege of working with you enchanting young people all the time. No, I mean it. It's great fun. It keeps us young. And we have great students here, and that's no BS. And we have had for years. You are talented and engaging and curious about things, and also very kind, I think, especially over the last 10 or 15 years. We've had unusually nice people in the program. I'm not sure that they're that way in political science or in engineering, but in music, everybody's very, very, very decent folks. I didn't answer your question, did I? Would you mind saying it again, please?
Well, I'm curious what you would spend the money on. You said you keep teaching.
Right.
Would you risk making an opera house?
Probably not.
Good answer.
No, you can never break even. If you're running an opera company and you're in a constant battle to raise funds, it is no picnic. I wouldn't want to do it. It's best, Tabor could afford it, at least for a while, and he was not unusual. There were rich businessmen in Atchison, Kansas, a man named Price. There's a man named Boyd in Omaha, Nebraska. There was a man named Toodle in St. Joe, Missouri. There was another man whose name I can't recall in Sedalia, Missouri. All of these wealthy businessmen who, once they had established themselves, wanted to reinvest in the community. Colonel Kersey Coates in Kansas City was another one. And they built opera houses, named them after themselves, naturally. But they did it. They weren't on such a lavish scale as Tabor's opera house. But there was a great interest in out on the Great Plains in the latter half of the 19th century in importing culture. A lot of these people had grown up in the East. And there was also a certain competition between your community and the next large town, and you wanted to establish your artistic credentials, and you wanted to prove that your small burg was more cultured than the next burg down the line. So, by golly, we in Kansas City are better than those folks in Sedalia. Yes, sir. Or Topeka, Kansas has a better opera house than Abilene. Etc. And look here what we can do, and look at all the attractions that we can bring here. to make this the center of culture. I mean, it came along with building churches and schools. They were very interested in providing for the next generation and establishing music and culture out on the plains. I think we've lost that quite a bit now. People are, the leading men are more interested in building a football stadium or something. Yes, Julia. Well, 1964, I believe the notes say.
How many great historical buildings that were torn down, and why were they torn down then? And now it seems like now we're looking back and oh, we wish we had those relics from the past.
Well, I do too. Part of it has to do with maintenance. In my hometown, Topeka, Kansas, the Grand Opera House was a movie house when I was a kint. It lasted until 1982. It was the second oldest opera house west of the Mississippi, the oldest being the Boonville, Missouri Opera House, which had been erected in 1876. The Grand Opera House in Topeka had gone up in 1882. But by 1982, it was too expensive to maintain it. They did a study, and it would have cost several million dollars to renovate it. It was in terrible shape, and nobody wanted to invest that kind of money. The taxpayers weren't willing to pay for it, and there wasn't any Horace Tabor around. Professor Armeling, do you know? I don't. Is there a plaque? You're a Denver native. Is there a plaque we're standing there? Do you recall where the old Tabor Grand Opera House used to be?
Not that I know of. He's asking me because Denver is my native city, and I had left even before.
It was torn down?
They had before they tore it down. So I don't know.
Well, it had, as I understand from the former editor of Colorado Heritage, by the time it was torn down, it was in what was regarded as a rather seedy district of Denver. And you nice people didn't go down there. That was no longer the she place to be. Is that the way you remember it as... Is that district that being in decline?
Yes, absolutely. There was, I think it was Curtis Street. You could go down Curtis Street, but don't go beyond that.
But they've renovated that district now, haven't they?
It's very, very posh.
Yeah, and there's a trolley or a tram that runs up and down. Is it Curtis or Larimer? I almost got hit by it one time. Well, you don't hear it. And it moves a lot faster than, it's like a train. It moves, it's moving a lot faster than you think it is. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that is maybe electrically run.
Mm-hmm.
You get on and off.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very convenient. If you don't get run over by it, that's inconvenient. Other questions?
I'd like you to talk a little bit about how Tabor was helped by his first wife, because he really didn't do this alone, did he? And she was not ultimately so grateful
Obviously, he wasn't very grateful in the long run. Tabor had married the boss's daughter.
Uh-oh.
He was no dummy. And he had been working at as a stone cutter, I believe, in Vermont, and Augusta's father owned the business. Well, for some reason, they left Vermont, and they lived in Kansas for a while, and then and perhaps some other places, and then they moved on out to Denver. And for a while, they were running a general store, or its equivalent, in Leadville. He could never hang on to money. She was the manager, and she did an excellent job of making that business prosper. She was really good. But he, of course, struck it rich. He went into partnership with a couple of other men, the Pittsburgh mine, and they hit a bonanza there, a silver bonanza. And I believe he sold his third of the partnership for $1.3 million in 1879 money. So let's multiply that by 20. That's a lot of money. But that was just one of his windfalls. There were others in mining. He was extremely wealthy. And he was just throwing it, spending it right and left, and becoming, at some point, estranged from his wife. I'm not sure what went on, but you saw the letter that she wrote to him in September 1881. That was September. The following March, he shows up in a Durango court. Durango's way out in the southwest corner of Colorado. And I don't know why he's way out there. It's hundreds of miles from Denver. But I really do know why. He's trying to pull something. And he gets a judge out there to grant him a divorce from Augusta. But Augusta wasn't there, nor were any of her attorneys present. So this divorce was not legal. That's, I think, March of 82. In September of 82, meanwhile, he's been carrying on with Baby Doe. On September 30th, 1882, he and Baby Doe get a marriage license in St. Louis. And I think I've got a slide of that. At least the front, yeah, there's the front part of it. Yeah, September 30th, 1882. What's strange about this, though, is that Baby Doe didn't actually sign it. Her signature is not on there. I've got this chronology noted here somewhere. Yeah. So, that was September 30th, 1882. January 2nd, 1883, just about 4 or 5 months later, a Denver judge granted Augusta Tabor a divorce on grounds of desertion. And when asked whether she wanted this action, Augusta said to the judge, "Not willingly." That was January of 83. 2 months later, March 1st, 1883, in Washington, D.C., Baby Doe and Horace Tabor married a second time. And the day following the marriage, the Reverend Chapel, however he pronounced his name, the pastor of St. Matthew's Catholic Church, angrily claimed that he had been shamefully deceived by the bride's father, who had made no mention of Baby Doe's previous marriage to Harvey Doe and her subsequent divorce. The bride's father did not tell the pastor that. He returned Horace Tabor the honorarium that he'd been paid, and he returned the marriage license to the clerk's office unsigned. He, the pastor, would not sign it. And in the eyes of the church, that marriage never occurred. There's also another little incident. This goes way back to March of 1880, when it seems that Baby Doe positioned herself outside Lizzie Preston's Denver bordello. And by her side was a policeman, Edward Newman. Harvey Doe, her husband, appeared and entered the establishment. All right, it's nighttime, it's dark. He didn't see them there. Baby Doe, the policeman in tow, quickly entered, and inside they spotted Harvey, and that was enough. And 2 days later, she filed for a divorce and got one. So by March of 1880, she was divorced from Harvey Doe, who apparently was not a very desirable character. And he probably never went to the opera house and saw any operas. He strikes me as that type. Any other questions? Well, Dr. Nispel has been busy in the kitchen today, and she has created some goodies back there, so please help yourselves, and I hope you enjoy it tonight. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thank you.